Not stating it anyway. I appreciate that.
And I appreciate very much talking with you today for Between the Covers. Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Lauren Shainberg, author of the new book, Four Men Shaking, Searching for Sanity, with Samuel Beckett, Norman Mailer, and my favorite Zen teacher from Shambhala Publications. Larry will be reading at Powell City of Books on Thursday, September 26th at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more about his upcoming appearances and his work at lawrenceshainberg.com.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next on Words and Pictures, SW Concert speaks with local cinema archivists who present screenings of rare and risque films.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, featuring artists touring nationally and internationally. Shows start this September with Jim Queskin and Meredith Axelrod. The new season continues with artists Bill Staines, Radim Zenkel, and the Honey Whiskey Trio. Then 2020 kicks off with Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor, followed by Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, Robin and Linda Williams, Pat Donahue, and Joni Harms. Portland Folk Music Society concerts are presented at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steel Street in Portland. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're talking about classic cinema of the dark and risque variety. Dan Halstead is in the studio. Dan wears many hats at the Hollywood Theater. He's the head programmer for the theater, the impresario behind the Grindhouse Film Festival, and the wrangler of 70mm films and equipment here in Portland. Chantel Halstead is here. Also, she's the programmer of the Hollywood Babylon series of films that are produced prior to the Hays Code, and we'll find out what all that means very shortly. Chantel and Dan, thanks
Hello.
For coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
And it's always a pleasure also to be joined by Elliot Levine. Elliot is a local film archivist who's curating the classic noir series, I Wake Up Dreaming, at the Hollywood Theater. We'll be talking a little later also about his film studies courses at Cinema 21, The Rise of the Hollywood Western, and Alfred Hitchcock and the Psychology of Suspense. Elliot, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, Chantel, first, I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about the history of the Hays Code, or as it's properly known, the Motion Picture Production Code.
Yeah.
Yeah, my understanding is, there's this new technology back in the end of the 20s, early 30s, called the talking picture.
Right.
And there are some government bureaucrats who sort of looked at that the same way that politicians look at video games nowadays.
Yeah. Well, so the silent era, interestingly, so a lot of the pre-code movies dealt with subject matter such as prostitution or bootlegging or any other kind of malfeasance that people can come up with, you know. And silent films depicted that, but silently. So there'd be a title card intermittently placed where there'd be dialogue that explained or a scene explained. But then with the advent of sound, not only could you see what was going on the screen, but you can now hear what they were talking about. So if they were talking about something lascivious, like, oh, she's hopped up on goofballs or something, and then she's also rubbing her nose or, you know, like in Three in a Match, then that a lot of people had a lot of issue with that, especially if they brought their children to the theater. It was one thing to see it, but then to have their kids hear it and then take them home and they're mimicking what was being said on the screen. So this, that's basically what happened with pre-code as far as sound coming in and why there was a rush to police it.
Well, I understand that there were censorship boards in the States,
yes,
going back almost as far as motion pictures, like to the 1890s.
Yeah, 1897, I think, was the first censorship board.
But it wasn't a national obsession until the talkies came out. And then this fellow, Will Hayes, he was what, the Postmaster General?
He was a Postmaster General under Coolidge. And actually, he was brought on board in 1922 after the advent of scandals rocking the Hollywood community, such as Fatty Arbuckle and Olive Thomas.
Scandals,
the sex scandals.
And your series,
and
by
William,
the way, is called Hollywood Babylon.
Yeah.
And it may be a nod to the Kenneth Anger book.
A little bit, yes.
He was the avant-garde filmmaker who wrote a little tell-all about the early days of Hollywood.
Yes, and he was also a child actor. A lot of people don't know that.
Oh.
But where was I? I'm sorry.
Oh, we're talking about Will Hayes.
So we're talking about Will Hayes. So 1922, he was brought in to help police or come up with some kind of code of conduct for films and to clean up Hollywood's image as this place of debauchery. So came up with something called The Formula, which was a pre-code book of morals that should be followed and by the movie studios. So that because films were not under the purview of the First Amendment, they were considered a commodity and not art.
Mm-hmm.
And so the government could just come in and shut down a studio. They could censor anything that they wanted to. So they were under the impression, if we do this ourselves, then we won't have any problems with the government coming in, because people were going to their local congressman and saying, this movie is full of sex and violence and our children thing. It's always think of the children, because you're taking your kids to see The White Sister and stuff like that. I don't know why you would. But anyway, so up until about 1930, silent films, they could get away with certain subject matter because it was silent. But then by 1930, I think that was the last silent film that was made was 1930. I can't remember the name of it right now. In the United States. Mm-hmm. Which movie?
All Quiet on the Western Front.
Oh, you can join in here.
Yeah,
right?
Thank you. So with sound came a new set of rules. So they fixed it up a little bit more, the code, to emphasize more morals that they needed to be added to it. But the studios, just the year before, in 1929, the stock market crashed. People are desperate, they're out of work, they're starving, they're hungry, and this was the only form of entertainment, a universal form of entertainment that everybody could participate in.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody in Kansas can't just get on a train and go to Broadway in New York and watch a play, or bands traveled, but they didn't go to the little town. So movies
circus
were,
came around once or twice
exactly,
a year.
So the studios, they would submit scripts to be reviewed blue pencil, but a lot of times they would just ignore them and flout the rules, because people really wanted to see a reflection of themselves, and they weren't so concerned because they're starving at home. We don't care what subject matter is on the screen. They just wanted to be entertained, and people would line up around blocks to see certain movies, Scarface, I'm No Angel. All these movies would just pack houses for days and days and weeks. And
yeah, I think the perception was that there were all of these lurid movies that were out there that were just there to titillate people. But in fact, there were movies about government corruption,
yes,
about issues that were going on with prohibition,
yes,
about the loosening up of society with the motor car and things like that. And so these were incredibly relevant issues that were being played out in these scripts.
Yeah.
And some people just were offended by this reflection of what's going on in the body politic there.
Right, yeah. I mean, there was the rise of the Communist Party in the United States, because people thought that capitalism has failed us, and so we need someone to come in like Mussolini or Hitler. And there were movies made that glorified their way of governance and said, maybe this is the answer. Maybe we should have this kind of these kinds of people come in and clean it up. And, it was very socialist, very fascist in nature, like Gabriel over the White House. I mean, he just Walter Huston's character.
It's authoritarians
a story,
are,
but yeah.
Authoritarians are nothing if not cinematic. They've got all these great edifices.
Exactly.
And, of course, Leni Riefenstahl was one of the great artists of the early cinema.
Mm-hmm. Leni Riefenstahl, you should do a whole show about Leni Riefenstahl,
because
she's amazing.
She lived to be 100.
101,
and never did join the Nazi party. There's a lot of nuance about the life of Leni Riefenstahl. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, she's a rock climber. She made Das Blaue Licht. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but that and Triumph of the Will and Olympiad are the only movies I've seen of hers, but they're all truly amazing films. Beautiful, cinematic.
Yes.
But unfortunately, she made these movies for Hitler.
It's hard to live down being Hitler's girlfriend.
Right, exactly.
sometimes you just take the job you can get,
exactly.
I guess, if you're good at it. 1930s. So studios are churning out these films a mile a minute, and
they were making, I just read, Joan Blondell made 27 films between 1931 and 1933. Which is more than what Greta Garbo made in her entire career.
Wow.
they were, one example is William Wellman. I think he made 22 films in 4 years, the director, which he directed Night Nurse, which is the film that's going to be playing this evening.
William Wellman, who is the director of just all these classics, Beau Geste, mm-hmm. Public Enemy with James Cagney, Jean Harlow, and Joan Blondell.
And
as
Joan
you say.
Blondell, yes.
She was one of his favorite actors. The original Star is Born was mm-hmm. William Wellman.
He wrote the script, and he won an Oscar for that. And what was interesting about the scene in which Janet Gaynor's character Frederick March's character, he gets up on stage and A Star is Born, and he's drunk and he's upset and he's yelling at the Academy for, they're horrible people and whatever. That was actually his revenge, because in 1927, when he made Wings, he made this spectacular film that won the first Oscar, he was snubbed. He wasn't even invited to the ceremony.
Wow.
And he made this great film, made tons of money for all the studios, and it's his peers giving this award, and so he got his revenge by writing that little script for Frederick March to say in A Star is Born, which I find is fascinating. But a lot of people don't know that he wrote it. He didn't direct it, but he did write it.
There's this period during the early 30s mm-hmm. when the Hays Code is supposedly in effect,
right?
But it's largely being ignored. There's not enough bureaucrats to look through all the scripts.
Mm-hmm.
People are just sort of doing what they want. And then at some point in the mid-30s, the government just steps in and forces the studios to beef it up a little bit. They're doing more self-censorship. They're sort of blue lining their own scripts before they submit them.
Yeah, I just showed Gold Diggers in 1933. That was the last film that was played for Hollywood Babylon. And the studio actually made different versions of the movie, or they made different scenes and put them in the movie to play at different markets to appease certain censors in certain states. So that was one way they could get around it. Another way was they would just submit scripts little pieces at a time. But for the most part, it was actually mainly lay people of the Catholic Church that started becoming more vocal about the content of these films. Martin Quigley apparently woke up one morning and saw outside of his window, he was the head of the New York State Censorship Board, and he saw out of his window a billboard for some movie. I can't remember what it was, but it was salacious, like half naked ladies on it or something, and he was just outraged.
Goodness.
It's like something has to be done. And then Joseph Breen came into the picture, and they were the ones, most people call it pre-Breen, post-Breen, instead of the production code, because Joseph Breen, the man was, he was a piece of work. He was a racist. He was a misogynist. He was sexist. He was not a very nice person. But he was the one who said, this is what we're going to do. And he became head of the production the production code, basically, and rewrote it and made it more specific to subject matter. So everything went through the Studio Relations Committee, but did not get approval unless he said so. Every script, or his group of readers that he had.
It's kind of amazing how long, what a reach the Hays Code, the Motion Picture Production Code, had. I mean, it really only started loosening up in the 50s, about the same time that French critics, La Carte du Cinéma, the Godard, Truffaut, they started recognizing the art of what Americans had just thought, oh, this is just fun, one-off entertainment, these pictures. Like especially the monster movies from Universal.
Right.
That, it was about, yeah, it was about the time in the 50s that things started to ease up, because you also started getting foreign films from overseas that didn't have the production code, and those were playing where you had more adult themes.
Yeah, and also the breakdown of the studio systems. A lot of the moguls were dying or retiring in the 50s, and there were there was a push for more realism in films. They're bringing more playwrights, more method actors who wanted more realism in their characters and their scripts, and so that contributed a lot to the breakdown of, or the flaunting, or just the ignoring the code altogether up until 68, when we finally got the letter rating system that we all know and love today.
So you know, you are obviously born long after, you know, the new independent cinema came into effect and everything like that. But you believe in playing these on the big screen for a new generation. For one thing, black and white just looks better on the big screen.
It really does. And these movies, I mean, they encapsulate a time period that we can only read about or speculate about. Is, I mean, if you don't know anything about it, there's this preconceived notion that all black and white movies are these boring, dull, except for, you know, there are a few minor exceptions. Old-fashioned idealism. Everybody's really chaste and virginal, and nobody does anything wrong. If there's a bad guy, he's really bad, or if it's a bad woman, she's really bad, and they get their comeuppance. But these films really depict a realism that we didn't see again until the 70s or until the late 60s with the exploitation films.
And so you're setting these kids straight, and you've gotten a good reception.
Yeah, I'm really surprised and very happy that people have been so receptive to the series, because it's us on screen. And you know, you look at them and you think, really, not a lot of us is a lot of qualities of humanity has changed since then. I mean, we think of our grandmas and our grandpas as living in this age of purity, and it's just not true. It's our great grandparents. But I like looking back at these, or looking at these. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to watch these movies on TV. I grew up in the Bay Area, and there was a television station called Channel 44. And on Saturdays and Sundays, they played old movies all day long. And I would just sit there. KBHK, TV 44, San Francisco. They would play old movies all day. In the middle of the day, each day, they played horror films. So that was good. Mostly Hammer films or Godzilla movies, which was great. But they didn't play a lot of these movies, pre-code movies, because even then they were still deemed too salacious or too sensationalistic to play to a regular audience. I was just reading today about language that was used in a lot of pre-code movies, and how the policing of that came about, because there were, you know, you can't say certain words even now on TV or in movies. And then so they would go around it by using other languages to convey whatever was going on in the film. Like I was reading about one, somebody called somebody else a shiksa. And William Hayes said, what does that mean? We can't have these. What? That's not even a word. Is that a word? I was also reading about how in King Kong, Hayes wanted the script from the dialogue of the native peoples on Skull Island. He wanted to know what they were saying, even though it was a made-up tribe with a made-up language. But he wanted to make sure that there weren't words that people could look up the meaning to
he
them.
Takes his job
that's
very
how
seriously.
Far. Yeah, he took his job very seriously. But anyway, it also extended to advertising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Imagery.
Yeah.
So we no longer have classic old movies on, you know, weekend mornings on broadcast TV anymore. But you played a really instrumental part in making sure that people in Portland can still rent great old movies. And you, this is a meet cute story. Dan, you and Dan met at Movie Madness, which was a thriving video store at the time and is now possibly one of the last video stores in the Northwest, video rental stores in the Northwest. You brought it under the umbrella of the Hollywood Theater's nonprofit program, and you have thousands and thousands of titles from the 20th century.
Yeah.
My understanding is, say, if somebody goes on Netflix, they can find maybe less than 100 titles before 1980.
Yeah,
that's insane. Yeah, Movie Madness has over 80,000 titles, which is incredible. So yeah, Chantel used to work there back in the 90s, and so I had met her then. She didn't remember me though. So then we met later on.
Way to go.
I know. So then, but then she had introduced me to Mike Clark, the owner of Movie Madness, and we had done some events together, and then Mike came to both of us 3 years ago and had said that he wanted to retire and he didn't know what was going to happen to the business, and he was thinking about liquidating it. So Portland almost lost Movie Madness, which is a horrible thought. So he offered Chantel and I if we wanted to buy the business. And so we thought it over for about 48 hours.
Yeah.
Like, are we going to buy a video store? We'll be working there every day, all day long, just the two of us. And then it was her idea, why not bring it under the Hollywood's nonprofit? So then I pitched it to the board, and it was about a year of poring over the financials and setting up a Kickstarter, and then we launched it, and the city went crazy. And I probably saw half a dozen people cry the day that we announced that it was possible Movie Madness was going to go away. But we hit the $250,000 Kickstarter in less than a week, I think. And by the end of the month, we had raised over $300,000. And the store was saved. It's incredible.
So people now have access to great old films.
Yes.
In town. I'm SW Concert. You're listening to The Film Show. We're talking classic cinema today with Chantel and Dan Halstead of the Hollywood Theater and Elliot Levine from the Oregon State University Continuing Education Program. I want to bring Elliot in here. You have a classic noir series at the Hollywood Theater at the same time that Chantel's doing, well, different days. During September, the Hollywood Theater. Your series is I Wake Up Dreaming. You're curating that. And you're also offering film studies courses at Cinema 21, The Rise of the Hollywood Western, and Alfred Hitchcock and the Psychology of Suspense.
Yeah, we are looking forward to a pretty exciting fall quarter. I've been doing this now through OSU and Cinema 21 now for 2 years.
Oregon State University.
Oregon State. And the response has been remarkably overwhelming, very positive. Generally, these things take some time to develop, but this was pretty exciting right out of the gate. And the enrollment keeps, you know, getting larger and larger. So we added a second class. We're doing two classes a week now. And of course, the Hitchcock class we've done before, we're repeating it to give people who are only available on a different day of the week an opportunity to do it because it was so unbelievably successful. Westerns is going to be a little bit of a different kind of challenge. There is a certain kind of attitude that a lot of people have about Westerns. They don't seem to acknowledge the significance of these films, content-wise, and are generally pretty shocked, very surprised when they run into a Western that really moves them intellectually, emotionally, you know, the way good film is really supposed to work.
Well, you not only, when you're teaching these classes and you're interacting with the students and all the materials that are going back and forth, you're not only just talking about the history and the art, you're talking about sociology, you're talking about politics, you know, you're talking about a lot of moving parts that that are influencing what's going into these films.
Yeah, it's almost impossible to put together either a class or a series of films that are essentially genre films and expect not to get involved with politics because the B-movie, the so-called B-movie or the genre picture, especially in the 40s and 50s, was a great proving ground for people to, you know, get up on their own little platform and talk about things that were politically charged, whether it was mob violence or any number of social issues. Westerns and film noir in particular were the two genres that really went to town on that. And what made it really kind of fascinating, because Westerns and noir films of the 40s and 50s, well, they were still under, you know, the sway of the production code, but they didn't get the same kind of scrutiny that the big films mm-hmm. got. When you were making a new Clark Gable film at MGM, you could have like 18 guys from the censor board down there watching every move you make. So everything is perfect, nothing is offensive, nothing has to be reshot. But B pictures, the feeling was, well, you know, they'll make their movie, it'll be out there, it'll play on Skid Row for a week, and nobody will go to see it anyway. Why do we care? And the reality was, people did care. People did go see those films. And for like a whole solid period of maybe 15 or 20 years, people were watching subversive films and not exactly knowing it. They may have come away with some vague notion that something was askew in their world. And if they made the connection that there's something happening in the film that is a reflection of reality that's unpleasant, well, that's fine too. But mainly they were going, you know, to have an interesting time at the movies, not fully expecting to get a civics lesson in the bargain. So, yeah, that's, Westerns are, you know, gosh, I mean, I can wax on about Westerns all week.
Well, Westerns, I mean, you know, we've had multiple rounds of revisionist Westerns starting in the 60s and going into just recent times.
Oh, yeah, and that will happen every several years. Somebody will make a Western, everybody goes to see it, and then everybody else tries to make a Western, and nobody goes to see them. So it's one of those odd things where periodically an important Western will appear. And it's not that it starts out being important. It's just that audiences decide to make it important, and they go see it. It happened that way to Unforgiven, the Eastwood film. That briefly reinvigorated the Western genre, but to very little avail, really. Not much came out of it beyond that. But the films that we're really focusing on for this class were from, like, say, 1939 to 59, which is when this whole idea of the so-called adult Western or the psychological Western mm-hmm. really, really took hold of the movie-going consciousness. And you had the prime motivators like Anthony Mann and John Ford, Bud Bedeker. These were the guys who were making the substantial Westerns that people were paying attention to, watching, and maybe even creating a whole new level of interest for them movie-wise. It really elevated the whole Western genre. Previously, it had been really, and I don't want to denigrate the idea of B-movies, because they were B-movies, and I love B-movies more than A-movies, but these were like, Western B-movies are different. They're just like 60 minutes of guys riding around on horses, because it's cheap to do that. Mm-hmm. You don't really need sets and that sort of thing. You go out to the ranch and make your film in 3 days. And that's how people kind of viewed Westerns, until John Ford made Stagecoach. Yeah. And that kind of really kicked the barn door open, so to speak. And before you knew it, people were really making more serious Western films.
Yeah, they're really taking a look at, expansionism and some of the politics of what was going on with Native Americans, which comes up, of course, in The Searchers. And then, you know, in the middle of this stretch, as you're talking about, McCarthyism comes in. You've got the hearings, the HUAC hearings on Hollywood and
that
Hollywood
became, 10. Yeah, by the early, mid-50s, that became a major thematic concern with Westerns. And a lot of the people who were making these Westerns, whether they were writing them, whether they were directing them, a lot of these guys were being on the verge of being blacklisted. So they had an axe to grind. So you look at a film, even like Johnny Guitar, the Nicholas Ray film. That film in itself is a walking metaphor for the McCarthy hearings. It's the way it's set up. And even though Nicholas Ray was
amazingly strong women too.
Well, and that's another
that's
consideration.
The yeah.
of the, exactly. Because if you look at the syllabus for the Western class, there are several films in there. 40 Guns, which is a major Sam Fuller film with Barbara Stanwyck, and she owns that film. Mm-hmm. Johnny Guitar with Joan Crawford. She owns that film. She is the protagonist. And everyone else around her is really subservient to that role. And it's really remarkable. And I think that's a big part of the revisionism that people like to talk about with 50s Westerns.
Well, Elliot, how can listeners find out more about the screenings at Cinema 21, I Wake Up Dreaming, and your classes, your courses the screenings at Hollywood Theater, I Wake Up Dreaming.
Yeah, I'm too busy, aren't I?
And your courses at Cinema 21.
They can go, if they're interested in the courses, the OSU courses, they can go up onto the Cinema 21 website, and that should direct them to the OSU site. As far as the I Wake Up Dreaming at the Hollywood Theater, they could either go to my I Wake Up Dreaming Facebook page, or they could go to the Hollywood Theater's Facebook page or their website and learn all about it.
And Chantel and Dan, how can people find out more about your series, Hollywood Babylon?
Hollywood Babylon. So tonight we're going to be showing Night Nurse with Barbara Stanwyck. That's at 7:30 at the Hollywood Theater.
And a young
Clark Gable.
Unmustachioed Clark Gable, yes, which the studio did not hang on to him, to William Wallman's chagrin. And the next movie we're going to show a special film next month. Usually Hollywood Babylon is bimonthly, but next month we're going to be showing on October 10th the 1931 version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with Frederick March, which I think is the definitive version of that story.
It should be the only version. It should be the only version you see.
Well, thank you very much, Dan and Chantel Halstead, Elliot Levine, for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm SW Conser. Thanks to all our listeners today on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. Thanks, as always, to the Oregon Media Production Association for their support and collaboration. The audio for the show will be available later today on our archive page, kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And you can keep up with us on Twitter, at Words and Picture.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time volunteer coordinator. We're excited to find someone to manage KBOO's volunteer program and be responsible for the day-to-day coordination of volunteers as well as their training. For a full job description and instructions for applying, go to kboo.fm/volunteer-hire-2019. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, for more information, go to kboo.fm/volunteer-hire-2019.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host the 10th anniversary of Right to Survive.